We're going to be looking at Ecclesiastes chapter 6 tonight. Ecclesiastes chapter 6. And we stumble upon a couple of verses that could be labeled a paradox. And I'm sure you remember what the term paradox means. A paradox is a statement or some sort of proposition, perhaps a situation even, that seems to be absurd. It seems to not make sense. Perhaps it's contradictory. But even though it does seem absurd, even though it seems contradictory, nevertheless, it also could be true. So we call that a paradox. Paradox is what we find in verses 1 to 2. At least that would be one way to describe what is presented in chapter 6. Let me read those two verses. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is prevalent among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, but God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity and a severe affliction. We've seen already the subject of money and wealth come up more than once, and it seems like Solomon keeps going back to that because that's something that people keep turning to for their fulfillment in life. It's what they put their hope in. And so he describes something that he has observed under the sun, he says. That's that little phrase that reminds us of horizontal life, life here on this earth. And he's just making an observation of something he's seen about this life here. It's not something hypothetical. He has seen it in this earthly experience, something that does happen in the earthly realm. And what he has observed here is a paradox. It's a paradox because it's a situation that has to do with the affluent, first of all, those that we would say, because we assume they have it all, those we would say that have got to be happy, at least the world would say that. You look at them and they lack nothing. There's riches, wealth, and honor, according to verse 2. And yet, though we might say in our terms, they've got it made, they have all they need, they have it all, still, something is missing, which means appearances aren't all there is. He has it made from appearances. But in spite of all these enviable delights that this person enjoys, this individual is blocked from enjoying those delights. There's a block going on. He can't eat from them, it says. And that's just another way of describing enjoyment. It doesn't mean literally just eating and nothing else, but it's really consuming all of this and enjoying it. There's a block there. God has not empowered him to be able to do that. So on one hand, he has everything that would make him happy. And on the other hand, he's not happy. He has everything that we might say from a worldly, under the sun viewpoint. He has everything to make him fulfilled and satisfied. And yet he's not satisfied. There's a block there. Because prosperity without this divine gift of enjoyment ends up being nothing. Which brings us back to a recurring theme in the book. And he says that in verse 2. It's vanity. All is vanity, is said more than once. There's another way we might describe this scene that he's picturing here. Besides the word paradox. We might call it irony. But a cruel irony, we would say. There's an unfair twist going on. It seems an unfair twist that God would, on one hand, allow someone to have all this, even give them the ability to make it, and yet remove from the person the ability to enjoy it, or block him from enjoying it, or use something to keep him from enjoying it. That seems a very cruel irony, a very unfair twist. And when these kind of things happen in life that seem to be paradoxical, or they seem to be ironic, but from the cruel side, or they seem to be a twist, but yet unfair, we end up evaluating then God based upon those things. Something's wrong with the picture, would be another phrase that we throw around. And so Solomon's saying, yeah, it appears something's wrong in the picture, that God would allow all this and yet not allow the person to eat from it, to thoroughly enjoy it. He presents something else wrong with the picture. He says, instead of this person enjoying it, something frustrates him. In particular, he says a foreigner enjoys them. Instead of the individual enjoying his affluence, a foreigner has come and ripped off the benefits. Now, Solomon doesn't tell us who this foreigner is or what he means by that. Our first really impression would probably be that it's a person of some sort of enemy, an adversary. It certainly could be that, a personal enemy to this person, someone that's given them grief in life, someone, a business associate that's ripped them off. I don't know, someone that has come in from out of nowhere and done something or taken something from him. Somehow there's an influence here that is frustrating the person's plans in life. I think we're allowed, because of the bigger point Solomon is making here, to really broaden our understanding even of what this frustrating foreigner is. Yes, it could be an adversary. It could be another person. But think about it. There are all these things that encroach into our lives, these foreigners, that rob us of our happiness, that frustrate our plans. And that's what's going on here with this person that Solomon has observed. We could broaden the definition to include things like the sickness. I mean, that's something we don't plan on. It's something that we try to avoid. And the reality is that even a wealthy person, a person who is having all the riches and wealth and honor here in verse 2, when it comes to sickness, sickness and disease can rob that person of their enjoyment of life just like it can anybody else. Sickness and disease can, out of nowhere, come upon somebody so they no longer enjoy the delights of life, the delights of what they've accumulated, their riches, their honor. I mean, when there's severe sickness and disease going on, all those things just don't matter anymore. There's other kinds of things that encroach in that rob us of our happiness. Domestic troubles, domestic conflict. I mean, when there's trouble at home, in that very important arena of our life, that definitely takes all the fun out of life. I've talked to more than one person along the way who had riches and wealth and honor, and yet because of severe conflict at home, trouble in the family, whether it's between a husband and wife or some severe issue with a son or daughter, I've seen it where all those things don't matter anymore because life is miserable. There could be calamities that come along and eat the spoil instead of us enjoying them. I've moved here from Southern California, obviously. We have our share of calamities out there, whether it's earthquakes or mudslides or massive fires. I mean, we've been involved intimately in at least two of those. The mudslide was a good quarter mile away, so I didn't have to worry about that one. But we've had to evacuate for fires all around us. I've been on the floor at 4:31 in the morning, January, 17th, somewhere around there, in the Northridge quake, trying desperately to get off the floor, not able to stand up because the house is shaking so bad, just trying to get to my children's rooms to somehow see if they're okay. Things like that we don't plan, and when we view those as calamities, natural calamities, other places, it could be floods, could be tornadoes, could be hurricanes, could be blizzards. My point is, whether it's a person, a business associate, or some other individual all of a sudden that has risen up against us in some way, an adversary, that kind of foreigner, or whether it's a sickness or disease that's come in, or whether it's some sort of domestic conflict that we're having to deal with, or whether it's some sort of natural calamity. The bigger point is the presence of these foreigners often cause people to think, what's going on with God? I mean, what kind of God are we serving? What kind of God is it that's out there? I know you've heard of the book entitled When Bad Things Happen to Good People, written by Rabbi Harold Kushner. In our study of Jerry Bridges' book, Is God Really in Control? There was a quotation in one of those chapters from that book. A very popular book that came out several years ago, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Here's some quotes from the book by this rabbi. Life is not fair. The wrong people get sick, and the wrong people get robbed, and the wrong people get killed in wars and in accidents. Some people see life's unfairness and decide, quote, there is no God. The world is nothing but chaos. That's really a theme that kind of runs through his book because it ends up being his perspective as well. In fact, he comes to his own conclusion. He asks this question, are you capable, asking his readers, are you capable of forgiving and loving God even when you have found out that he's not perfect? He came to conclude that God was not perfect. God makes some severe mistakes. To create a paradox like this in somebody's life, that's a major mistake on God's part. Or to allow the foreigner to come in and to rob us of our joy, that's a major mistake on God's part. If you understood the vantage point of that book by Kushner, you'd know that he was writing it from the vantage point of a grieving father. It was the death of his own son that prompted him to write the book. It's from that perspective that he ends up reaching conclusions about God and asking questions like the one I just read or making statements like this. Quote, even when he, God, has let you down and disappointed you by permitting bad luck and sickness and cruelty in his world and permitting some of those things to happen to you, he asks, then can you learn to love and forgive him despite his limitations? What a view of God. It's really a blasphemous view. That God is not perfect, that he makes mistakes, that he's not on top of things. I mean, can you love and forgive him once you figure out and finally realize, you know what, God's really limited. Well, see, these kinds of thoughts are the kind of thoughts that enter people's minds because of paradoxes, because of cruel ironies, because of unfair twists in life, especially the loss of the world. I mean, they began to think like this about God. Sadly, even God's people have been known to question him, though, when things go wrong. Shocking to admit. But the fact is, foreigners in life end up doing a real job on our thinking sometimes. They do a number on us, whether it's the wars that are going on in the world and the killing that's going on or the terminal illness that we hear about or that we find out is our own or the tragic natural calamities that happen where people are killed. These kind of things take away our hopes. They end up frustrating our dreams in life. Solomon calls it, at the end of verse 2, a severe affliction to deal with things like this. Unfairness. Paradox, cruel irony, a severe affliction. You could literally translate the end of that. This is vanity and something that presses heavily on the man. That's really the idea there of the Hebrew. It's an affliction because it's like a weight that presses down heavy on him. So what do people do then? Well, they seek remedies. Man's always and constantly seeking a remedy to this problem of paradox and irony and unfair twist in life. They seek to then add something else into the mix. Let's mix something in. Maybe something else is missing. Maybe it's not the things I thought would make me happy. It's something else I need to add to my life experience, and that'll solve my problem. So what kind of things do people mix in to their life experience? What kind of things do people try to find fulfillment in and hopefully reverse their lack of fulfillment? Well, I'm not at all saying that Solomon is giving everything that people add to, but in his world, if what he sees there and what he observes, he does give us, starting in verse 3, some of the remedies that people turn to. Things that are additives to life. Here's one, verse 3. Here's the first remedy. Many children. Big family. If a man fathers 100 children, that'll do it. I mean, that's what he's saying. He's saying that this is part of the solution some people have. That if we just have a family, or for some I've talked to, that if it just could have a child, have children in general, or have more children, or have a bigger family. Solomon is just saying, even if that happens, even if someone turns to a bigger family, has more children, that won't make a depressed life free from depression. We, if we're honest, we know that bigger families just bring increased and often bigger responsibilities and sometimes thankless, you know, tasks and responsibilities. Even if somebody has increased children, things may not turn out. I mean, it's possible that for some reason that his life could even be taken from him. His life could be taken from him completely, and he's not even allowed a proper burial. Verse 3, if a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, however many they may be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he does not even have a proper burial, then I say, better the miscarriage than that. Interesting point for Solomon to make, that for this person, he may have all that he needs or all that he thinks he needs, and he's tried to find fulfillment in a bigger family, evidently. Solomon says that for this person, it's been better off a miscarriage. I mean, in a miscarriage, a child is conceived in futility, ultimately, and goes into obscurity. That's sort of the observation. This child never sees the sun. Verse 4. Comes in futility, goes into obscurity. Verse 5. Never sees the sun, never knows anything. That child's better off than he, this individual, trying to find happiness in a bigger family. This child has no history to live up to. He has no problems to endure. He's not going to have to deal with anything about this life. He doesn't have a name that he has to make for himself. He doesn't have to try to pursue a character and a reputation. Solomon is just saying there's a case to be made that if you're trying to find your fulfillment in some sort of experience, family experience, you've been better off just miscarried. Along with that, he does mention many years. I mean, some might throw that in, that that's what it is. If I just live forever, I don't have fulfillment right now, but if I can live a long life, have many years, eventually I'll find fulfillment and happiness. For some, this is the solution to frustration. We just need to live a longer life. Solomon says no. Look at verse 6. Even if the man lives 1,000 years, twice, I mean, he's just exaggerating. I mean, 2,000 years, two lifetimes of 1,000 years. What good is it? He's not going to find fulfillment. It's just 1,000 more years of sorrows, ultimately. And regardless of whether or not he lives this inordinate amount of days, the end result is still, verse 6, they all go to one place. The Old Testament calls that Sheol. It's the place of the dead, the realm of the dead. Death is going to come. So again, go back to verse 3 through 6. If a man fathers 100 children, here's somebody who's trying to mix in family life. I mean, I'll just have a family with a lot of children and there'll be even increasing fulfillment in that. No, you'd be better off never having come to fruition and birth. Then you won't have any problems. That's better. Family is just going to bring more problems. More children, more problems. Well, if I can live a 1,000 years, a long life, then I'll have more time. Somehow this whole thing will evolve and I'll find fulfillment. No, you're still going to go to the same place all dead people go, the realm of the dead. Verse 7, he says, here's something else people try to mix in. This will fix it. It's hard work. Hard work. So whether it's an increased children, number of children, or more years of life, perhaps it's hard work for some person. Verse 7, all a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. I mean, maybe the problem is he's got too much time on his hand, and so he's just thinking, if I work harder and work longer, that's going to reverse this tragic irony, this tragic situation of my life that was in verses 1 and 2. And the answer is going to be no, of course. Just so you know, the word mouth is really just referring to feeding. You know, he's saying that he's going to work more because generally we're not just working for pleasure. We're trying to get something out of it. You know, we're trying to earn a living, more living. That's what mouth is representing there. But yet, he says the appetite is not satisfied. That word appetite is translated most of the time as soul. It's the word nephesh. I remember one of the first Hebrew words I learned early on was the word nephesh, because you learn it in biblical anthropology. What is man made up of? What is this thing, the nephesh, the soul? It is this word nephesh, but here is the idea of appetite. There is this soul satisfaction, the soul that has all these feelings and these enjoyments, these inclinations that it wants to fulfill. And yet, though man's labor is aimed at fulfilling all that, he never arrives there. The appetite is never satisfied. So mixing in work doesn't fix it, doesn't remedy this paradox, this irony. It doesn't bring satisfaction to an empty life. Hard work doesn't bring relief from depression if there's conflicts in the soul. I mean, there's a picture here in your mind, perhaps, of a guy on a treadmill, and he's just going to work on and on and on, and yet he's left empty because the problem is something inner. It's his inner life. Verse 8, what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? Here he's mixing in, perhaps by some people, increased intellect, more wisdom, more education. And he's touched on these subjects before. Once again, the subject is no. The answer is no. What advantage does the wise man have? What advantage does a person have if he's mixed in education and he's learned wisdom? Nothing. What advantage does the poor man have knowing how to walk before the living? That's an interesting statement. It's talking about a poor man. He may not have all the riches, but nevertheless, because of his wisdom, he has gained some insight here. He has gained some charisma. He's gained some personality. He has the charm to know how to impress others. He knows how to live a life in front of others, to even fool others, so they don't really know that he's poor. He knows how to walk before the living. But he's no better off than the one who really has everything. So the bottom line here with verse 8 is all men end up being ruled by their desires. The problem is not intellect. The problem is not work. The problem is something internal. It is this idea of the appetite, the hunger of the soul. Every man, whether you're wise, a fool, whether you have intellect or an education or none at all, whether you have riches or whether you're poor, no man can satisfy his own desires on his own. He's always going to be left hungering for more and the appetite not satisfied. So again, to review, you have a paradox. From observation, by most people, you'd say, here's someone that has everything, and yet they're not happy. Life is continually being frustrated by reality. Put your hope in family life, reality is going to frustrate it. It's not what you thought it would be. Put your hope in long life, many years, that somehow something's going to work out eventually. You'll come to the end of your life and look back and realize it never happened. Reality is going to frustrate it. You're going to work hard, more hours. Reality is going to frustrate it. You're going to seek education and wisdom and insight, whether you're rich or poor. You're going to find that reality is going to frustrate it. It's almost as if Solomon is shouting out in these verses something. He's shouting out, stop dreaming. Stop thinking and hoping that somehow you can add a few details that are missing, some sort of piece of puzzle that's missing, that you'll add that, and you'll somehow take this grim, drab life and you'll make it something fulfilling. Stop it. Stop dreaming. It will not work. So it becomes very candid. Verse 9. What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. It's a bit of a proverbial saying here. He's basically saying, come to grips with reality. Come to terms with it. And he's saying it to both the wise man and the fool, both the rich and the poor, saying the same thing, that what you're able to see, the thing that you have, where you really are, is better than all the dreams that you could possibly put together or may hope for. What the eye see is better what the soul desires. There is a colloquial saying that we have that captures that same idea. You'll hear people say it. A bird, what's the rest of it? In the hand is worth what? Two in the bush. Okay, you've all heard that? The older you are, the more you've heard it. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. In other words, what you have, yes, there's two out there, but you don't have those. You have one. Come to grips with that. Here's the way your life really is. Here's reality. Put it in food terms, since we kind of mentioned the word appetite. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Here's another translation of that. A Chick-fil-A sandwich in your mouth is better than pheasant under glass in your mind. Okay? A Sonic hamburger in your mouth that you actually have is better than the dream of a delicious, expensive steak at a ritzy place. Why? Because dreams get frustrated. Foreigners enter in. Life has this way of frustrating dreams and goals and the thing that you think is going to make you happy. As soon as you think you reach it, a foreigner enters in. Dreams really don't fill empty stomachs. I mean, all the wishing for things that we want ends up being worthless at some point. And Solomon is not really saying that there's never have a dream, never have a goal, or that we don't need dreamers. The problem is something different. The problem comes when we live in a fantasy land and we refuse to face reality, the life the way it really is, and deal with it like that. And that's what Solomon is talking about. He's saying don't make tomorrow and what you think you're going to able to get somehow, don't make an idol out of that. Don't make an idol out of a dream. Don't make an idol out of a plan or a goal, something that you think is going to fulfill if you just get that thing, whatever it is. Don't think that by simply imagining amazing thoughts that suddenly your life is going to become everything that you imagine. Dreaming sets us on a collision course where what happens is reality and fantasy ending up colliding in life. They butt heads. They collide. You hear some of this in the world sometimes, particular songs, and I'll hear the lyrics that you can become something like, you can become anything you want in life, And you hear that when they interview people that have somehow reach their dreams, somehow and become famous, the message they want to send out to young people is that, your dreams really can come true. No, they don't necessarily come true at all. You can't do anything you put your mind to. No, life frustrates it sometimes, severely so. In the Christian world, for a while, and I guess it's still out there, is this whole idea of positive confession, that if you just keep confessing something in a positive way and keep naming it and saying it, that you're going to materialize it and cause it to happen in life. No. You can confess some things as positively as you want to the rest of your life, and it'll never materialize. Why? Because life can frustrate it. There is something called reality that perhaps is very different than your dream, your idol. So what's the solution then? How should we live? I mean, with all that said, what's Solomon going to tell us? Well, he makes some observations here in verses 10, 11 and 12 that are very helpful then. He's observed something under the sun. That's a reality of life, but now he's going to make some observations that we need to make that end up being the conclusion, the summary then of what to do, how to live, what our perspectives ought to be instead of an idol out of a dream, and how life ought to be that it's not, and always wishing for something different. What do we really need to think? Verse 10 is this. We need to think this and remember this. God is sovereign and we are not. God is sovereign and we are not. There is somebody else in the picture. He told us about him back in verse 2. God gave the riches and the wealth and the honor. That was what God determined for that individual. But God has to give something else. He had not empowered this person to be able to enjoy it. And God is the one that's allowed the foreigners to the realities of life to enter in. God is sovereign and we are not. Verse 10. Whatever exists has already been named. And it is known what man is. Whatever exists has already been named. That's a proverbial way of saying that there is a particular plan for the world that God is in charge of. And so at the very heart then of life's struggles is something theological for people. The problem ends up being a theological problem. The question that you've got to really deal with is this: is God in charge of your life or not? Is God in charge of everything that's going on in this world in some way, whether I understand it or not? Do I believe that God is in charge or is He not? The reason riches fail to yield any happiness rests on something about God, an ordinance by God. He's in complete control of all the events. That's reality. That God is orchestrating the events of life in some way. Things that He sovereignly causes, things that He sovereignly allows, it all eventually goes back to something about sovereignty. And that He is sovereign and we are not. I mean, from God's vantage point, everything is somehow fitting into His will. I mean, if you jumped into heaven all of a sudden and just got a glimpse, you would not find panic going on in heaven. You wouldn't find any shred of that. You wouldn't hear, as you observe God working, you wouldn't observe Him doing things and hear Him periodically say things like, "Oops, see if I can fix that. Didn't mean to do that." You'll never hear "oops" from the lips of God. You'll never observe anxiety in His face. You know. In fact, you would be totally stunned and amazed with perfect calmness on the part of God in all that He's doing. Because He sees things. He understands things. I mean, verse 10 says, whatever exists has already been named. That is saying that God, someone is behind all this. It's been named, and God is the one that's named it, and God is working out His will. What we do is, instead of seeing the way it is in heaven, we just make our observations here, and we come up with the paradoxes and the ironies and the unfair twist of life. You've heard this illustration before, and it's very, very apropos. I mean, it's very accurate. It's that illustration of the tapestry, or the cross stitch stuff that people do. Okay, anything involving threads that has on one side the beautiful picture, but on the other side a conglomeration of threads and knots and frayed ends and twisted threads and things like that. That's okay. See, life is kind of like that. I mean, what appears to us though, as threads that are all frayed and loose ends and knots and stuff that all runs together and doesn't make sense, what we're seeing is the back of the tapestry. That's sort of the way we see life. But God is threading all that. He's doing all that, and He's forming this beautiful picture that is His will. It is His plan. That's the front. I think the problem is we live on the back side of the tapestry. But from God's perspective, it's all under control. When the foreigner invades, we begin to doubt God. We begin to doubt everything about God, that He is sovereign. We try to take things into our own hands and become sovereign, but we're not. God is sovereign and we are not. We can say it another way with biblical language. God is the potter. We're not. We're the clay. And just so you'll know, clay has to have a potter. Clay cannot shape itself. Clay, by definition, needs a potter in order to become something. Oil paint is the same way. Oil paint needs a painter, needs an artist. It can't paint itself. And that's the way it is with our life. We are these lumps of clay, and God has His will, and He's orchestrating things, sovereignly causing, sovereignly decreeing, sovereignly allowing. It's all ultimately some sovereign act of God. And He's in the process of painting. He's in the process of cross-stitching. He's in the process of forming clay. Because clay needs that. God is infinite and we're finite. That's another way we could say it. God is consistent and we're inconsistent. God is all powerful. We are limited in strength. God is faithful. We are irresponsible and confused at times. We are totally different from God. He is totally different from us. And more than once in his journal, Solomon has come back to this issue of the sovereignty of God. He just says it in different ways. Whatever exists has already been named. So come back to that point. God is sovereign, we are not. Second, come back to this perspective. Arguing is fruitless. Arguing is fruitless. Taking on God and debating with Him and fighting against Him is a waste of time and effort. Let me read 10 and 11. Whatever exists has already been named, and it is known what man is. Known by whom? God. For he, man, cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he is. That's a proverbial way of saying that here you have man. You cannot dispute. You cannot fight against the one who is stronger. Who's the one who is stronger? He's talking about God here. Verse 11. For there are many words which increase futility. What then is the advantage to a man? Try as man will to wrestle and contest God's decision and God's sovereign plan, regardless of how much he talks, the more empty and unsatisfactory he sounds and the more empty and unsatisfactory the situation becomes. It is fruitless to argue with God and dispute against him and to fight against him. I like what C.S. Lewis said on this subject. Quote, when you are arguing against him, you are arguing against the very power that makes you able to argue at all. Hold your place there and turn to Isaiah chapter 45. Isaiah 45, 9 to 12. This is a great chapter that you ought to read the whole thing on God's sovereignty. Isaiah 45, I'll read just verses 9 to 12. Woe to the one who quarrels with his maker. That's really what Solomon is saying. It's fruitless. All the words are futile. To dispute with God, an earthenware vessel among the vessels of earth. Will the clay say to the potter, what are you doing? Sounds like Romans, doesn't it? Or the thing you're making say, he has no hands? Woe to him who says to a father, what are you begetting? Or to a woman, to what are you giving birth? Thus says the Lord, the Holy One of Israel and his Maker, ask me about the things to come concerning my sons, and you shall commit to me the work of my hands. It is I who made the earth and created man upon it. I stretched out the heavens with my hands, and I ordained all their host. It's just a way of expressing that God is sovereign. Man is not. And if he argues with the potter, it is like clay arguing with a potter. Look at Daniel chapter 4. Verse 35, turn to the right. Daniel 4, verse 35. Daniel 4, 35. And all the inhabitants of the earth are counted as nothing. But he, God, does according to his will in the host of heaven. And among the inhabitants of earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what hast thou done? See, back in Ecclesiastes, at some point, people are asking questions about the paradoxes. They're asking questions about the ironies and the cruel, unfair twist of life. God, what have you done? Solomon says, don't argue with God. You can't dispute with someone who's stronger than you. Many words just increase the futility. There's no advantage to man. I mean, to argue against God and to say things like, God, what have you done? I'll tell you the answer you'll get if you're going to do it. If you ask God, what in the world are you doing? The answer is, my will. I'm doing my will. It's what I have done. It's what I am doing. It's what I will do. I will always do my will. That's really the point of verse 10. Whatever exists has already been named. And it is known what man is, for he cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he is. For there are many words which increase futility. What then is the advantage to a man? I think this is probably, certainly could be, the biggest theological issue that people have to put to rest in their lives, the sovereignty of God. When you finally put the issue of God sovereignly to bed, you stop the fight. You stop arguing. You stop kicking against reality. But as long as you fight God, as long as you fight His hand, as long as you fight reality, you don't learn the lessons He's attempting to place before you in your life. You have to remember that everything that touches you comes through the hand of your Heavenly Father in some way. It's a Heavenly Father. He's a Heavenly Father who continues to love you perfectly. He continues to maintain control of your life. He continues to be totally responsible for your life. That's what He does with His created things. That's why He's God. So I do encourage you. I counsel you tonight. Put this issue to rest. Come to terms with the fact that God is completely sovereign and you are not. Come to terms with the fact that arguing against God and even trying to ultimately figure Him out so maybe you can dispute with Him more, it's fruitless. Recognize and confess how futile it is to fight against the sovereign hand of God. And when you put it all to rest, then what you've come to conclude is this. Our responsibility is then to trust Him. To trust Him. It's like reality, all the foreigners that come in. It's as if reality are just continually ways for God to shut doors in your life. Slam them shut. He slams every door shut except one. And it's called faith. It's called trust. He keeps bringing you and me to places in our life over and over and over again where we can do nothing else but trust. It's a good place to be. Sort of like what the Mosaic Law did. You know, all the rules and regulations of the Mosaic Law, according to Galatians, what that was continually doing was guiding a person to come to another conclusion that he could never work it that way. It was a tutor, Paul says in Galatians, to teach us that we need a Savior to teach us, to tutor us toward the cross. That it was hopeless trying to live according to the law. I mean, the law is just a way to keep shutting doors so that a person ends up realizing all he has left is faith, trust. That's the way life is for us as well. God shuts doors. He frustrates our plans. He allows them to be frustrated. So when you find yourself getting anxious about something again, it's usually because the size of life under the sun, the size of mankind, the size of people, the size of whatever has gotten larger in your mind than the size of God. That problem, that challenge, that issue, that circumstance is larger than God. Or to use Solomon's terms, the horizontal, the under-the-sun perspective is overshadowing the vertical perspective again. We've momentarily lost sight of who's on the throne, who's in control of everything. Now, what's Solomon's purpose with all this? Is it just so you can learn a little bit about his life? I mean, he's an egomaniac here. He just wants you to know what his life is like, what he thinks is right and wrong. No, this is under the inspiration of the Spirit. The purpose of all this is that we see ourselves better because of what he's writing, through the counsel of Scripture, that we understand life better and how to deal with it, how to live better, to help us come to terms with reality. That's what Ecclesiastes does. It's a reality check. Chapter 6 especially, but the whole book is a reality check. Verse 12. For who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during the few years of his futile life? That ought to prompt a question in your own heart. Does life seem futile to you? Are you trapped in this somehow? Does that word futile and life go together for you and ring a bell in your own mind? If so, it's because you're still holding on to some dream that reality is going to frustrate if it's an idol. If I could just work for this company, if I could just live over here, if I could just own one of those, if I could just, fill in the blank. But there's an inescapable fact here. None of these conditions will give us what we long for, and we'll end up just disputing with God and arguing with Him. For who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during the few years of his futile life? Is your life futile? Do you think that way? He will spin them like a shadow, for who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? He's talking about the future now. As you look toward the future, are you fearful about the future? Do you think about that? Who can tell a man what will be after him? That you get caught up thinking in the after all the time. What's out there? What does the future hold? And sometimes life keeps going by so rapidly that the rapid passing of time just hits us, really hard, and we get face to face with it. And we think about the future enough and what's after that and what's after that. There is something out there that we know is coming called death. There is an end to it somewhere in our future. And the problem is death doesn't really announce its arrival. It doesn't really send you a letter and tell you how much time you have left or anything. So here's life that could end up being very futile from a person's perspective. You just ask yourself that. Is that you? And there's this issue of the future, what's coming. Do you fear that? Are you concerned about that? If you come to grips with what Solomon is really saying here, that God is sovereign and you're not, that it's fruitless to argue with Him, and that when it's all said and done, put all that to rest theologically so that you are at rest theologically, then you will find that you can now deal with life realistically. And the frustrations that come along are not something that's messing up your plans in life. It's something that God has allowed for a reason, and you trust Him for it. And you take the challenge, and you deal with it. You see what biblical principles apply, and you apply them. You see what you need to obey, and you obey it. You see what changes you need to make, and you change them. You see how you need to grow in your trust in God, and you trust Him. That's living life in a very stable way, see. It's very possible to live life, a life of instability. And the person who's unstable is that person who's constantly living in dreams that have become idols and they keep getting frustrated. But the person who's thinking rightly about God and His sovereignty and trusting God instead of fighting against Him, that person is going to live a very stable life. There'll be waves that come, but they're more waves that just sort of kind of make you lean one way or the other. But you're like a ship with an engine and a rudder, and you just keep going the right direction. Knocked around a little bit, but you don't get off track. I like the way Christ described the two kinds of living. In the Sermon on the Mount, He talked about the man who built his house upon the rock, the man who built his house upon the sand. In some ways, Solomon is observing people whose lives are built upon sand. The waves keep coming, storms of life keep coming and knocking down the house, But there is this other kind of person that Solomon understands now. He's been learning all this, and he's journaling it for you. It's the person who, instead of arguing with God and trying to live in a dream that's an idol, he understands what's real. He lives in that. And he's like that man whose house is built upon the rock because he's thinking rightly about God. And Christ now gives us even more information about that, that the house built upon the rock, the life built upon the rock is the life, the person who hears Christ and obeys what Christ says, who knows Christ. We have the full definition of all that now. And really, how you define your life, is it built upon the sand or the rock, really answers your questions even about the future. If it's built upon the rock, Christ, then you're ready to face the living God someday, regardless of what the future holds. No matter how much time you have left, no matter what happens with your job or your family or anything else, whether you have just a few months left or many, many decades of life left, it doesn't matter. Life is built upon the rock, and so it's not futile. It's stable. But if it's built upon the sand, living horizontally, then it is futile. Just so you'll know, one last thing. More than one writer on the book of Ecclesiastes has come to a conclusion. Now, there's no way for me to really know this. It's just been proposed as a possibility that, especially in this section, verses 1 and 2, that Solomon was writing about himself. That this observation is especially personal to him. Because if you read what Second Chronicles says about Solomon, you find that he definitely fits this person in verse 2. Second Chronicles 1, verses 11 to 12, God said to Solomon, "Because you had this in mind and did not ask for riches and wealth or honor or the life of those who hate you, nor have you even asked for long life, but you've asked for yourself wisdom and knowledge." Remember, Solomon asked God for that. "That you may rule people over people whom I've made you king. Then wisdom and knowledge have been granted to you, and I will give you riches and wealth and honor." Same phrase used. Solomon asked God for wisdom, and God says, "Because that's what you asked for, good request. I'm going to give you the wisdom, but you know what? I'm going to give you all the rest too. Riches, wealth, and honor, such as none of the kings who were before you has possessed, nor those who will come after you." You do wonder about that. He says, "There's an evil which I've seen under the sun. It's a heavy, heavy weight. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that his soul lacks nothing of all he desires. But God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. It's vanity and a severe affliction, a severe weight." Maybe he is talking about himself because of the language there. He's speaking out of personal experience, not just what he's observed in someone else, but personal experience here, that you know what? When you're not thinking rightly about God and you're living in dreams and wanting more and trying to add on other things to your life instead of the one thing that matters, life will be futile. "I've learned it," Solomon possibly says here. We do know he learned it. So he says, trust God. Let's pray.